Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Thursday, the 21st of April. Good morning and welcome to Africa Link, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Coming up in this edition, the battle against HIV/AIDS. Are African countries on the right track? We hear from an expert.
It's not only that there is a lot of deaths, but also there is still a lot of transmission going on. 27% of the deaths worldwide linked to AIDS are happening in Western Central Africa.
The people of South Sudan express apprehension over Riek Machar's failure to return to the capital, Juba.
A bit disappointed that he has not arrived at the designated date, and we still hope he's going to come, he's going to reverse his decision to come to Juba.
All that plus our drama series Crime Fighters in the next 25 minutes. Stay tuned.
Top story.
In 2013, when Ghana was declared a middle-income country, it all sounded good news. It implied that the country could now finance many of its own programs. However, some sectors are already feeling the pinch of reduced donor funds. The health sector is one of them. The country's AIDS Commission, which previously derived its funding from donor agencies, is finding it hard to manage. HIV/AIDS patients are worried that things could get out of hand. As Maxwell Sook reports, the Commission is now lobbying the private sector to raise the necessary funds to support its activities.
Langa Amadu pulls out his antiretroviral drugs, known as ART, to take a daily dose. Langa is an HIV-positive person living in Tamale. He says the drugs have kept him alive up to this day.
I don't know the day I contacted HIV. But I was diagnosed 2006 and I started the ART 2006 to date. You see, as I'm sitting with the 10 years, I've never been admitted at the hospital.
Previously, almost the entire budget for the management of HIV/AIDS in Ghana was funded by donor agencies, including the Global Fund. But since the country declared itself a middle-income status, donor support has waned. Providing testing kits and drugs is now a challenge. Langa and other sufferers are worried.
We are scared because we live by the drugs. So in case that the drugs is not there, what are we going to live on?
Ghana recorded a consistent decline in general adult prevalence of HIV between 2003 and 2013. But there are still challenges in fighting the disease. Many sufferers have no access to antiretroviral treatment. The Ghana AIDS Commission, an agency responsible for the management of HIV/AIDS cases in Ghana, has begun lobbying the private sector for financial support. Nuhu Musa, the Commission's technical coordinator in the north of Ghana, explains.
We are looking, at the end of the day, completely eliminating HIV as a country. So that is where we need all available resources to make sure that we don't leave any stone unturned.
Agnes Ganda, head of a social development charity in Tamale, welcomes the idea.
I think the call is long overdue, and all of us, you encourage the private sector and individuals that have more and can share should try to support the AIDS Commission to help our vulnerable brothers and sisters in that condition.
But some Ghanaians are skeptical.
In my candid opinion, I don't support it. That is what I can say.
Ghana's AIDS Commission is scaling up interventions to achieve a zero record in HIV/AIDS by 2020 as a global target. And while it's a public knowledge in Ghana that the private sector's involvement in the national HIV response has been relatively insignificant, Ghanaians are now waiting to see what impact this loud cry will make in the fight against HIV/AIDS in Ghana.
Maxwell Sook with that report. In line with the story, Doctors Without Borders just released a report detailing the state of HIV/AIDS in West and Central Africa. Entitled Out of Focus, the report reveals that millions of people in the region are being left out of the global HIV response. I've been speaking to Matt Phillips, who co-authored the report, and I started by asking her what exactly was happening on the ground.
At the level of the health centers, is that there is still quite a backlog in assuring access to ARVs in countries in Western Central Africa. It's not only that there is a lot of deaths, but also there is still a lot of transmission going on. 27% of the deaths in worldwide linked to AIDS are happening in Western Central Africa.
When I was looking at your report, I did realize that the UN AIDS campaign on HIV response is also about reducing the new infections by 95% by 2020. Is this a realistic target considering the state of the affairs at the moment?
Yeah, well, the epidemiologists have looked at that. And so they are clearly saying that if we succeed in getting 90% of people that know their status, and from those 90% on ARV, and those 90% having an undetectable viral load, this means that we can really curb the epidemic. But they say also that if we don't succeed to do that by 2020, then the number of new infections of HIV will increase again.
But there's also been some kind of outcry in some West African countries, not the smaller countries like you just pointed, but in countries that are relatively popular like Ghana, who have expressed lack of resources to address the HIV/AIDS-related health problems. Is the international community still interested in supporting African states to combat the pandemic?
Yes, well, there I think the general climate of the international aid is less favorable than a few years ago. And especially in terms of mobilization of resources, it's a bit in contrast of what is being said.
Let's talk about perceptions. How do people see HIV/AIDS at the moment in the whole of Africa?
The situation is not the same in every country. Most of the countries in the region of Western Central Africa, they have very different and much less, where in lots of countries of Southern Africa, HIV is seen as a chronic disease. If you take your drugs well, you have to take them every day, but and lifelong, you can lead a normal, healthy life.
I was talking to Mitt Phillips, the co-author of that report.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Anxiety, that's what is clearly evident among many people in South Sudan. The reason is that the vice president designate Riek Machar did not arrive in Juba this week as expected. Instead, he postponed his arrival indefinitely. This leaves the formation of a transitional government of national unity and hopes for peace in suspense. Wake Simon Wudu has been talking to people in Juba to get their reactions.
Hopes were dust this week as Riek Machar suspended his return to Juba for a third time, this time indefinitely. Citizens across South Sudan as well as the country's government are still holding out for Machar's return to Juba. But these hopes and even those of the international community are now growing thin. Hiboska Caroline, a South Sudanese national, says Machar's failure to respect the deadline for his return to Juba could set the peace deal.
I'm concerned because it's delaying us a bit in the implementation of the peace agreement. We're already behind schedule, and his delaying in coming is still, it's making us go a bit also very behind. But we still have hope that he's going to come. I know he can't afford to disappoint all the nationals of South Sudan.
Cesar Urudi says he too is becoming too concerned with Machar's delays.
We are a bit disappointed that he has not arrived at the designated date. And we still hope he's going to come, he's going to reverse his decision to come to Juba. Otherwise, we saw hope, but now the hope is slowly fading off, but we still hope they'll work together.
William Ezekiel is the spokesman of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLM-IO Advanced Team Machar's Movement in Juba. He told the dozens of journalists waiting for Machar at Juba International Airport on Tuesday that logistical and administrative reasons were preventing Machar from coming to Juba.
We are deeply sorry once again to announce cancellation of the arrival of His Excellency Dr. Riek Machar, the Indorgun, first vice president, who is supposed to come today to Juba, is not coming to Juba by today.
But government spokesman Michael McQuay told the journalists a different story.
The government was informed that he wanted to come with an arsenal of arms, in inter alia, anti-tanks, laser-guided missiles, and heavy machine guns. The government of the Republic of South Sudan will not accept any additional arms or surplus forces to be brought to Juba.
Already, 1,370 members of Machar's protection force is in Juba, and more 1,500 troops are yet expected to come after he returns to the capital. Disagreement over security matters by the two parties have derailed the implementation of the peace agreement. Now the United Nations, the U.S. and South Sudan's peace deal monitoring body say Machar's delayed arrival to Juba is putting the peace deal at risk. The two parties, government and opposition, are already far 8 months behind schedule on the implementation of the peace agreement.
Wake Simon Wudu in Juba. In Zimbabwe, human rights activists are still demanding to know the whereabouts of Itai Zamara, a journalist who was a harsh critic of Mugabe's government. During this year's independence celebrations, Itai's brother, Patson Zamara, held out a poster reading, "Independent but not free, where is my brother Itai?" Patson was arrested but later freed with no charges. I spoke to our correspondent in Harare, Privilege Mshandri, and asked him about the government's response so far.
So far, there has not been any official statement from government regarding the arrest and the assault of Patson Zamara. On independence on Monday, the 18th of April, he managed to sneak into the VIP area where the presidency and the ministers were sitting. So he just pulled off his placard and asked, "Where is my brother?" You know, the placard was just written, "Where is Itai? Today is independence, we are free, but not free." And he was then briefly detained at a police camp. But then there has not been any official statement to say what happened and government's position on the incident.
What about citizens? How have the people of Zimbabwe been reacting to this arrest?
Human rights defenders in Zimbabwe, particularly the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, which is currently, you know, defending most of human rights activists and those people that are being violated by the state, has issued out statements to condemn the incident, to say that, you know, he was exercising his constitutional right to press the government of President Mugabe to say or act on the disappearance of his brother. There was a planned demonstration at to Parliament to demonstrate against his arrest and beating, but it never took place because since last week when the Movement for Democratic Change held a huge march in Harare, there's been a very high presence of security around the Parliament building, so they failed to demonstrate.
Just this week, another journalist was arrested over an article criticizing the government. Is the situation in terms of freedom of the press and freedom of expression in Zimbabwe worsening?
We can't really say it's worsening or it has been worsening, because there's not been any significant change in terms of the freedom of the press and of freedom of association. You find that in the past, it was very difficult to organize demonstrations, but there has been some semblance of relaxation of those punitive laws with the coming in of the new constitution. It's sometimes overzealous police officers who sometimes act without the authorization or without any instruction from the state authorities, especially from the government authorities. So you find in different cases you can have just an overzealous policeman who can just come and harass you for exercising your constitutional right.
Privilege Mshanri in Harare. Now it's time to listen to this week's episode of Learning by Ear. Crime Fighters is up next.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Hello and welcome to our brand new series. It's called Crime Fighters, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill. And the author is none other than Mukoma Wangugi. This is the first episode, entitled Death Has No Manners. We invite you to come with us to Ketagu People's Republic in Africa, where Detective Kalumba and his team are about to investigate a new case.
It always begins with a dead body. Always. Yet we work on behalf of the living. This is what we tell ourselves, that justice is for the living. But I've long suspected that we, the detectives, the deliverers of justice, also die a little each time we come across a dead body. Death is absolute. Living is finite. In the encounter between the living and death, death steals a little piece of the soul each time. I know many detectives who've taken to drugs. My partner Chalkbank is a good man, but these last few years, death has started to win him over. Now he comes to work drunk, sometimes even high on drugs. Salamisha, one of the few women detectives on the force, and me, we're trying very hard to pull him back. This is what I was thinking about as Chalkbank, Salamisha and I arrived in a wealthy suburb out in Malu, the capital city of Kitagu People's Republic. A young man, Peter, had just been found dead.
Ooh, Kalumba, Salamisha. Oh, Jesus. Look at the size of this place. It reeks of wealth. Look at that marble. Oh, you see that silverware? That would pay my rent for a month.
You mean you could get a month's supply of weed or cocaine? I guess we can count on your expertise.
Ah, Salamisha, why must you keep bringing up my past?
There's no past for people like you, Chalkbank. Once an addict, always...
Stop it, you two.
Okay, okay.
At least show some respect. The parents are here.
Good afternoon, detective.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
It was obvious what had killed him. Drugs. Small bags of cocaine and probably illegally procured pain medication, narcotics, lay on the bedside table. There was vomit all over the bed, but no signs of a struggle in what was otherwise a tidy room. Suicide? The drugs could have been administered by force. But even if it was suicide, we still had to answer some basic questions. Who sold him the drugs that killed him? And who were the drug dealers working for? We had to follow the drugs and the money.
Mama Peter, Baba Peter, there's no need for you to see this. Is there somewhere we can go talk?
Yes, let's go to the sitting room.
Walking from the bedroom to their sitting room was like walking through an exhibition of luxury. Obscene wealth in a country of paupers. Or 10 millionaires and 10 million beggars, as someone once said. But I'm not a politician. My job is to find the murderer. What I do know is that the filthy rich are also rich in enemies.
Detectives, thank you very much for visiting us in these difficult circumstances.
Would you like anything to drink? Water, soda, beer?
No, thank you.
Beer for me, please. I'm just being polite.
I also get my best ideas after a few beers. I'll call the housewife so he can bring us some.
Sir, madam, what can I get you?
Fuma, give this man a beer at once.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
At your service, sir.
We are trying to establish a motive. Do you know anyone who would wish harm to your son?
He was such a gentle, loving boy. I can't think of anyone.
Baba Peter, if you don't mind my asking, how did you make your money?
What? So now my money, our money, is the problem? My boy is lying there, dead, and all you can think about is our money?
You must forgive us. Death has no manners, and neither does my husband.
I'm sorry, but I must ask. It could be important.
I'm an old man now. All my debts are settled. I made my money buying cheap real estate, renovating the properties and reselling them at a profit. All above board.
Was Peter in any trouble?
Like my wife said, he was a good boy. He was 21 and he loved to go to parties and discos. But he was never in any trouble.
Did Peter have a girlfriend?
No.
The thing is, until we hear from forensics, we won't know whether it was suicide, a drug overdose, or possibly murder. But if it does turn out to be murder, the sooner we start investigating, the better.
I can tell you right now, it's not suicide. He wouldn't do that to his mother. And where's the suicide note?
Who found your son?
It was Fuma.
The houseboy? Would he...
Give drugs to our son? Or kill him? No, certainly not. Fuma's been with us since he was a boy. He's like a son to us.
Detectives, I'm sure you understand. We need some time to be with our boy.
Yes, of course. One of the uniformed policemen will accompany you to the morgue. But as we were leaving, Fuma secretly handed us a note. Nothing here is as it seems. Meet me at 6 p.m. at the lounge. So off we went to the lounge, with the ever-thirsty chalk bank leading the charge. The Fuma we met there was nothing like the houseboy we'd encountered earlier at Baba Peter's. He was wearing expensive shoes and a mismatched three-piece suit, which I was pretty sure belonged to Baba Peter. And he was smoking expensive-looking cigarettes.
Hey there! Three beers for my guests. Unless the lady wants something more ladylike.
Beer is fine with me.
Five beers then. Two for the lady and one each for the men. And some chairs for my guests.
So Fuma, why are we here?
Walls have ears, and so do houseboys. I often overheard Peter talking on the phone. It sounded as if he was into hard drugs.
Do you know where he got his stuff?
Yes, I do. But I have to be honest with you. I go there myself from time to time.
It's all right. We're not going to come after you for that. The coroner might say it was a suicide. But if it was murder, we want to be informed and ready.
Then you are in the right place. Just look around. You'll find what you're looking for. I'll be right back.
Wait a minute. Were you very close to the boy and his family?
Since when have sheep and lions been friends? Let me water the nation, as they used to say. I'll be right back.
Who the hell is this guy? I mean, do you believe that...
The Lord save your souls, my children. Give your souls to the Lord Jesus Christ.
What the hell is this preacher man doing here?
You know how the preachers of Getagu are. They simply have to visit the den of sin.
There is no God at the bottom of your beer bottles. There is no salvation at the tip of a needle. Drugs, drugs everywhere. No water to drink. Marijuana, cocaine, fake drugs for malaria, for measles, for AIDS. Drugs to cure, drugs to kill. Come to the Lord, my children, and you'll get real medicine. I promise you, healing medicine, not false drugs.
Hey, get out! Out of the table!
Salamisha, Kalumba, are you okay?
That's it for today. What's going on in the bar? Tune in next time to find out what's happened to Salamisha and Kalumba. In the meantime, you can listen to this episode again on our website, dw.com/crimefighters. We would also like to hear what you think of our new series. Let us know on our Facebook page. Until next time, bye-bye.
And now a recap of our main stories. West and Central Africa are still struggling in their fight against HIV/AIDS. And in Sudan, the hope for a peaceful transitional government is fading. With that, we come to the end of today's program. AfricaLink returns tomorrow same time. From me, Jane Aiko Kumet, have a splendid day.